interest. I'm Emily Brennan, and here's your 90-second pro bono news update. In the wake of the Orlando shootings, incoming Lambda Legal CEO Rachel B. Tiven is calling for a renewed effort for federal and state laws that explicitly protect LGBT people, including a federal anti-discrimination law and LGBT-inclusive hate crime laws across the country. You can read her full open letter on lambdalegal.org. 68% of detained immigrants in California do not have lawyers to represent them in their deportation proceedings, according to a new study from the California Coalition for Universal Representation. The study also found that immigrants detained in California who have an attorney succeed more than 5 times as often in their cases as immigrants who do not have legal representation. Read more at centrolegal.org. During her commencement speech at Penn Law, Attorney General Loretta Lynch called on graduating students to use their skills to combat discrimination, stating, "Today, your tenure as students of the law comes to an end, and your career as stewards of justice begins." You can watch Attorney General Lynch's full remarks at youtube.com/pennlaw. Iowa and South Carolina recently passed legislation to benefit refugees, which Human Rights First explores in depth on their website at humanrightsfirst.org. Two organizations are dishing up jobs for at-risk youth, according to a new article from the Council of State Governments Justice Center. New programs are providing work in food trucks to help educate young adults about entrepreneurship and help keep them off the streets. Visit csgjusticecenter.org for the full story. That's it for the update. Here's our interview with SABA's Will Gonzalez.
Welcome to the podcast, everyone. I'm Emily Sutcliffe, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Will Gonzalez. Will is the executive director of SABA, a coalition of Latino community-based organizations in Philadelphia, and is also the former president of the Hispanic Bar Association of Pennsylvania. Will, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here with you.
So SABA employs a unique nonprofit model. Can you tell us more about your organizational structure, what you do, and who your clients are?
Thank you. So SABA is a small coalition, and it's deliberately small for organizations that have been working together for quite a long time. And what we seek to do is to coordinate our activities around increasing civil rights in the community, housing rights, financial literacy, and bringing together entities to provide one place where people can get various services at one point of contact, and from that build with a relationship with the clients over time. Addressing the needs of low to moderate income folks is not done by using a silver bullet. It takes a relationship building. It takes multiple approaches and multiple interactions and time. And so I think that's been one of the blessings of working with the SABA Coalition. I think another important thing is that when we talk about financial literacy, when we talk about housing, we understand the value of civil rights. When we do our financial literacy workshops, we make sure that we include matters like what are your rights as a worker? What are your consumer protection rights? What are your civil rights when you get stopped by the police? What are your health rights? Because all those affect your pocketbook, which leads to economic development.
Great. Before we talk more about kind of what SABA does every day, can you tell us a little bit about what got you on a personal level into this line of work as an attorney?
I graduated from law school in the late 1980s. I did a clerkship with a county judge in New Jersey, and I ended up taking my first legal job with a legal services organization, Friends of Farm Workers. I always wanted to do work with low to moderate income people in distressed neighborhoods. I was blessed to be able to take a backpacking trip through South America with my wife for 3.5 months. We had built that in, and I did a lot of thinking, visited civil rights organizations. This was in the early 90s, 1991. So it was a great experience, and I thought made me think a lot about what most lawyering is. Most lawyering is to come in after the China is broke. And I really wanted to do some work which was preventive and that at the same time was empowering and also at the grassroots level. And I was blessed to meet some people who were doing that when I came back to Philadelphia and started by working on some matters related to police accountability, where we did a lot of great work with an organization called the Police Body Relations Project. I think the other thing that I like to work on is on things that no one else is working on. So for example, on the police accountability matters, the police department had a way to deal with complaints, but it was not being utilized because it was ineffective. And so I and we, the people that we worked together on this, decided that we were going to use that system to build a case to show that the police needed to do some reforms. So as people before we came in were shying away from filing reports, we would file them, administrative reports, and then track them, and then built enough of evidence to show that the police weren't following up on these administrative reports so that then we could do a class action working with the American Civil Liberties Union, the NAACP, Professor Radofsky, and others that led to some changes. Using that same approach, I moved on to matters related to economic rights and saw that people were not being as aware through housing counseling or through ways of building their asset base. And specifically when we talked about immigrants, unauthorized immigrants weren't aware of some of their economic rights. So those are the types of things that I've dedicated the last 15 years to building on.
Great. So you talk about economic rights. One of SABA's main goals is to promote the financial inclusion of Philadelphia's Latino community. Can you talk to us a bit about what financial exclusion looks like? I think this is an issue many of us don't realize even exists.
Well, I think you're meaning as to how people are not made part of some of the economic development that's taking place in some places. And we all know that 99% of the wealth is owned by 1% of the country, and that income breach is getting bigger, and it's gotten bigger and bigger over the last four or five decades. One of the things we're trying to do is to try to help people, as they make connections with our organizations, provide multiple approaches to helping them increase their asset base. And by asset base, I mean with a small a, not only by saving money and not spending it on things that are not as productive, but also save money by not engaging in transactions that end up ripping them off or not giving them enough value. Also increasing their financial literacy, obviously working and addressing the ways that banks interact with our community, how people borrow money or get affected by discriminatory practices in borrowing money. We seized on an approach that uses taxes as a gateway. There's nothing more comprehensive that we all do than do our taxes. So as we do free tax preparation for folks, which saves money in itself, people now are charging $300-$400 for a simple tax return, even selling quote unquote peace of mind for $50. We would use the session, the tax preparation session, to see what a person's household situation was and then encourage them to use income supports like food stamps or other ways to increase their asset base, enter into structured savings programs, and make them aware of other things that could help their families. So that's the type of work that we've done. We've done an approach of hands-on, one-on-one counseling to group financial literacy sessions, to working with entities like Community Legal Services and Philadelphia Legal Assistance, with the help of from law students from the University of Pennsylvania and the Toll Public Interest Center, where students do pro bono work, to address some of the policy issues. We leave the litigation to outside attorneys, but that has been part of our arsenal as well. We worked with a professor, an adjunct professor at University of Pennsylvania called Ken Trujillo on a major class action lawsuit against some auto manufacturers who were using discriminatory lending practices. Using regression analysis, we were able to show that Latinos and some non-Latino whites were being charged different rates of interest, even though their economic situation and household income was the same. And so we were able to stop some of those practices and bring about some changes in that.
And so you talk about kind of how people in the Latino community, particularly low income, are treated differently within the same scenario as kind of other communities. Can you talk to us a bit about who SABA's clients are, what their lives are like, and what kind of the biggest challenges they face?
Well, we focus on the Latino community of Philadelphia. We try to stay small and focused on that. Some of our families do come from southern New Jersey and the greater Philadelphia region, the surrounding five counties, but most of them from Philadelphia. Philadelphia has seen the diversification of its Latino community. When I started working in Philadelphia in the late 80s, it was close to 90% Puerto Rican, the Latino community. today that the share of the Puerto Rican community in Philadelphia in relation to the Latino community has decreased almost 60%. The Latino community in Philadelphia has a very strong nonprofit community, but it wasn't being too receptive to non-Puerto Ricans. SEBA played a very important role to helping diversify the nonprofit sector services of Latino organizations to Latinos in Philadelphia, especially towards unauthorized immigrants. And it's led to a lot of positive economic development. The area that's called the Italian Market has gone through a lot of changes, and it's now really a strong multi-ethnic market that includes a large number of Mexicans and a large Asian community, and that has revitalized that area. It's the same thing as making South Philadelphia a destination to live. On one note, that's also created challenges because now the communities that help revitalize some of those areas, which they now call Queen Village and others, are now being displaced because the rents have gone up. But anyway, we played a role in helping those communities establish themselves in Philadelphia, do asset building. For example, a lot of unauthorized immigrant families have U.S.-born children, and those U.S.-born children are eligible to receive food stamps and other benefits. The whole concept of tax preparation services for unauthorized immigrants, some of them concerned about that. We are a certified acceptance agent for the IRS to prepare free taxes for unauthorized immigrants. That helps them secure the child tax credit. They can't get the earned income tax credit, but it helps them also recoup any withholding that was pulled from their checks. Some of them, about 50% of them, work with made-up Social Security numbers, so withholding is made to their checks during the year, and doing a tax return at the end of the year could help them recoup that. There are entities that lend money to unauthorized immigrants. Unauthorized immigrants are seeking mortgages. Believe it or not, 14,000 unauthorized immigrants in the city of Philadelphia live in owner-occupied housing. So it's a very vibrant community. Some of them are opening businesses, and they need an accurate tax return to help them if they're given a chance to qualify for legal residency in the country. Tied with that, connect them with immigration resources, i.e., to address status issues or take advantage of DACA and DAPA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. So things like that. Last but not least, I think one of the key things that we do is we take these complicated legal matters and we distill them down to easy-to-understand chunks, to things that are lowest common denominators. And then we try to explain that to the community by using the media, by using workshops to empower them with understanding and knowledge about these legal concepts, which sometimes are complicated.
So you talk about tax prep for unauthorized, undocumented immigrants. I think there's a perception that unauthorized residents do not pay taxes. Can you educate us on that?
Sure. It's very interesting. I know there's many Americans who are here legally who love not to have to deal with the IRS. But unauthorized immigrants pay taxes in many ways, from the sales tax when they buy things at the store, to gas taxes when they buy gasoline, to helping their landlords pay the property taxes when they pay rent. But last but not least, when they work, close to 50% of unauthorized immigrants use up made-up Social Security numbers, so the withholding is taking place. And then those that are not going through withholding or are paid in cash, they also have an incentive to file a tax return, especially if they have a family. And like I said, a large number of them, you know, there's 11 million unauthorized immigrants in the country, and there's close to, I think, 6 million children, U.S.-born children of those unauthorized immigrants. There's incentives to file taxes for many reasons, from getting the child tax credit to creating a record of what their earnings have been to help them secure certain economic benefits, be it loans, and last but not least, to prove their presence in the country. The individual tax identification number, which is a number that the IRS provides to unauthorized immigrants to file their taxes, is now being tracked by credit companies and credit bureaus. That also helps them establish their kind of credit-worthy presence in the country. And it's a city like Philadelphia considers the individual tax identification number as a tax ID number for purposes of business licenses. So even though they can't use that number to open maybe a business license in some other cities of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia they can. It's a very versatile vehicle for financial empowerment, asset building for that community.
So last week, SABA participated in an event entitled How Immigrant and Refugee Communities Can Strengthen Neighborhood Revitalization. In our current socio-political landscape, there is a great deal of anti-immigrant, anti-refugee, general anti-Latino rhetoric. Where do you think this wave is coming from?
I think it's obviously been building. It's not uncommon to groups of people. We see it in other parts of the world. We've seen it over our history. You know, the mountain people are against the valley people, and people from that tribe are against this tribe. And we recognize that this is used to divide and conquer. I think there's been an increase in rhetoric over the last few years with a zenith during the presidential campaigns here. But in a way, I think that rhetoric by some of the presidential candidates has been helpful. For example, the Republican Party at one time would look the other way when some of its leaders would say things that now their leading candidate repeats, and some of them are cringing at it because he'll take it to an extreme or he'll say it without sugarcoating. And I think that has been good because we've seen some of the leadership of that party say, you know, we don't subscribe to that, even though they would not say so if it had been said in a more veiled way. I think also it's going to bring to the fore when the election takes place in November, you know, where we stand, this country of immigrants, where we stand on this issue. I think the data has been overwhelming to show the economic impact that immigrants have, not only now as they have their hands tied behind their back with some of this rhetoric and some of the legal constraints, specifically around the unauthorized immigrant community, which is not going anywhere. To deport 11 million people is a logistical nightmare. But if you tried to do that, it would be very expensive, number one. And number two, what are we going to do with all their children? You're going to put them in orphanages? So, you know, it's just silly. And as people start thinking about this stuff and digesting it more, and then think about it. Right now, yes, unauthorized immigrants can get some loans. It's very limited. But if they all had legal status, there's this concept in economics called the multiplier effect. Their multiplier effect is constrained by their inability to have access to credit as anybody else. They would start a housing boom, a car boom. They're buying homes now with strong limitations on credit, they're buying cars now with the inability to do auto financing. It would just be a tremendous rush of economic development. And I think that's bringing to the fore people finally recognizing that again. That forum that you referred to was an awakening by the nonprofit housing development community. We talked about developing awareness of immigrants and unauthorized immigrants within established Latino communities. Now we're starting to see that happen outside of the Latino community to other nonprofit communities. Philadelphia is blessed to have a very strong housing and economic development sector on the nonprofit level. And now it's starting to see that there are benefits and challenges and rewards to addressing the needs of immigrants and authorized immigrants and refugees.
And so we see immigrants and refugees being kind of spoken about together more frequently in recent times. Have you seen any changes in recent years in terms of Latino immigrants and economic refugees and other refugee communities as a result of the current ire towards immigrant communities?
Yes. Philadelphia, again, we are in a special place, which is Philadelphia, which has been very welcoming. And we have seen an acceptance and an ability to work together. It's very tough to work with the communities because they work so much. They have 1, 2, 3 jobs, so it's very tough for them to set aside time to be part of organizing efforts and other things. But that's where some of the work that we do can grab them at those moments, i.e. when we do the free tax preparation or when we are providing housing counseling for them. One of the things I'm very proud that SABA did was to open up the eyes of the Office of Housing and Community Development and other housing counseling providers in the city that unauthorized immigrants were eligible to receive housing counseling and to qualify for certain housing programs under HUD, especially when it's financed by community development block grants. So, Yes, I think there's a very strong network of legal service providers, immigrant service providers. The Pennsylvania Immigration and Citizenship Coalition also is a great place where people come together. So working together, together with the administrations, I got to give credit to Mayor Nutter, the mayor who just finished 8 years in Philadelphia, and to Mayor Kenney, who's starting his tenure this year, that have really been welcoming and speak frankly about the vital role that immigrants play. For example, Kenny is an Irish immigrant, and he talks about Irish immigrants coming into this country illegally and the roles they played in discrimination that they faced and the challenges and how they were able to overcome them by sticking together and how he wants to help the current wave of immigrants overcome them. Last, when it comes to refugees, the refugee crisis that's striking Europe and the Middle East, Philadelphia was one of the few cities that stood up and said, you are welcome. And organizations like Nationality Service Center and HIAS, they are making sure that they can accommodate and bring even more refugees into the city. It's a very positive environment to be working in, but it still takes a lot of work because it's you have to help people who are not as familiar with some of the legal concepts, some of the ways to get things done in a legal way through federal funding and other things so that they are in compliance and not stray, because that also can bring about negative publicity.
So if you could snap your fingers and just instantly change a law, a policy, a social norm, a common attitude that impacts the folks that Sable works with, what would it be?
Wow, that's interesting. I would say voter participation. We still, that's another area where Sable does some work. We have a democracy. We don't participate enough in the affairs of our government. And voting simplifies it in a way, you know, in other words, you just vote every election day. It could be twice a year. But I think there are other avenues where voters can participate, i.e. through public hearings, through jury duty. So getting more involved, what's happening is people have abdicated their ability to hold government and government officials accountable. And it seems that only those who are hiring people to do that job, i.e. lobbyists, are the ones who are holding government accountable or to whom government responds. So if we were able to get people to participate more in the affairs of government, that could help be government be more reflective of what the majority and what people need. TABA has done some work on that area by doing voter protection efforts, voter education efforts. For example, we work with the Community of 70 and Congreso and NALEO, National Association of Latino Elected and Appointed Officials, to create a small handheld little a card explaining what the rights and responsibilities of a voter are. We did that in English and Spanish. We've also done some workshops. We've worked to ensure that government is accessible to people who are limited English proficient. So over the last 16 years, SABA has taken a leadership role working with Community Legal Services to help ensure that Philadelphia government is truly accessible. That culminated last year with the help of Councilwoman Maria Quiñones Sanchez in a charter change that makes it obligatory in Philadelphia for every government entity to ensure equal access and to come in with a plan to ensure that. And that includes the city commissioner's office where people vote. So I think to me, that would be my wish.
As we kind of start to wind down a bit, you've really highlighted for us what a global, welcoming, diverse city Philadelphia is. But I know on your day-to-day, kind of you work with a lot of folks who are facing really big challenges related to poverty and other issues of injustice and inequity. That said, though, what are kind of things that inspire you, that energize you about the work that you do with SABA and with your clients?
I grew up in public housing. I grew up in Puerto Rico. We weren't very poor, but we had our limitations. Also grew up in parts of New York City and some other projects. So to me, it's being able to give back and help people rise up. We also see a lot of families that are single mom with two kids, very low income, and helping them take steps forward. Very brave women, very strong women, very hardworking women. I also like bringing people from outside the community to get addicted to help the community. I call it get addicted because it's kind of like I introduce them to it and then they see the value of their work, the how well received and appreciated it is, and the impact of their work. So I think that's one of the things that keeps me motivated and makes one feel that we are having an impact.
And as we come to a close here, what can people do to get involved not only with SEBA, but with the larger kind of issues of economic justice that SEBA works towards?
I like to tell people to find what their passion is and volunteer through those vehicles. So if you like working with children, it's very different than if you like working with bricks and mortar. If you have a legal skill and you like doing that, it's very different than if you have an accounting skill. So I say find what your passion is and then go and see where you can volunteer. I even say that to people who want to make a career out of it. There's no better way than to be involved first to find out truly what you want to do and then follow up. And then last but not least, if you're really crazy, you can use what you know to maybe start meeting a need in the niche that there are no services provided. It's not easy, but there's a certain passion and reward that you get when you do that. It's very interesting. I was talking to somebody who was telling me, you know, that they had met a lot of unhappy lawyers. I said, well, you're talking to the wrong lawyers, because I've met a lot of happy lawyers. I've met a lot of happy people who are working on things that they like to do. And I think that is, there's no better reward for your what you've spent so much time in terms of an education or devoting your time to perfecting a skill than applying them to things that you like to do.
Well, Will, thank you for being really crazy based on your definition and being really a beacon of public interest in Philadelphia and also at the national level. Thank you so much for joining us and educating us about SEBA's important mission. And thank you, listeners, for tuning into the podcast. To learn more about SEBA, visit www.sebaphiladelphia.org. That's CEIBAPhiladelphia.org. Thanks again, Will.
Thank you.
This podcast was produced by the University of Pennsylvania Law School. Learn more about public interest lawyering at law.upenn.edu/public service. Thanks for joining us.